me, and so I'm not going to be here for very long. And I'm not going to give you a bunch of stats about Bunning and his pitching, because you probably know more about that than I do. But I'm going to tell you a couple things about Jim that maybe you didn't know. When he was a kid, his mother got him a BB gun. He liked most kids. He would go around shooting that BB gun, and his mother finally said, "I guess you're never going to be happy until you put somebody's eye out with that BB gun." Well, in Jim's favor, I got to tell you, he never did put anybody's eye out with a BB gun. But in his mother's favor, he never really was happy. He went to all kinds of doctors, and finally he ended up going to a guru over in India, way back in the Himalaya Mountains. So there he was, back in this cave with this guru, sitting there cross-legged. And the guru finally said, "What's your problem?" And Jim said, "Well," he said, "I've never really been happy." And the guru said, "Did you ever put anybody's eye out?" But we've been friends a long time, and it's a distinct honor for me to get to even be where Jim Bunning is. I'm proud of him, and I know that we're going to enjoy him. But like I say, we've been friends for a long time. We've been doing nice things for one another over the years. And the one thing I did nice for Jim in 1956, when pitching for the Tigers, I never won a game. And that made it so that in December, they could trade me, and they gave my job to Jim. So that's how I was good to him. And he, of course, got into politics, and I was the mayor of that big city of Nay. And so I got to compare notes a little bit with Jim, called on him, and I told him how concerned I was about having to have mayor's court. And he said, "Well," he said, "if I can ever be any help to you," he said, "you got my number," he said, "just don't be afraid to call me." So the first time I had mayor's court, here they bring in this middle-aged lady, charged her with prostitution, and I asked her how she pleaded. She said to plead guilty. Well, now, I don't know what to do about that exactly, but I thought about what Jim had told me. So I called the recess, and I went back to the office, and I called Jim's number. I got him on the phone, and I said, "Jim, what would you give a 55-year-old prostitute?" And he said, "Never more than a dollar and a half."
That's bad, Dad.
So without further ado, I want to present to you not only my friend, but he's my candidate for something that's badly needed, in my opinion, and that's the commissioner of baseball.
Oh, God.
I'd like to see Jim have that job.
Sure.
Jim, it's all yours.
Thank you.
Baseball fans, it's a pleasure being back in Kentucky after being spending 4 or 5 days each week for the last 11 years in Washington, D.C. I really enjoy my time in Kentucky. And of course, it's good to see my old friend Ned Garver, and I also saw Paul Foytek somewhere out there. There he is. I did recognize him. He's a little different than the last time. But those are two of the people that I pitched with in Detroit. And I have to tell you just a little story about Ned, because it's very important to understand. When you finally make or finally get to the major leagues, you're not sure you're supposed to be there to begin with. You know, you've worked like the devil, and I worked 6 years in the minor leagues trying to get there. Pitched almost 1,000 innings in the minor leagues. So I had a lot of experience in the minor leagues, but there's a little difference between pitching in the minor leagues and the major leagues, and it's a matter of confidence. And of course, there's a lot of difference in the defense that you get when you get to the major leagues, because the defense behind you is the best in the world. But getting over that hurdle of trying to belong in the major leagues, Ned Garber gave me the big hand. Because when I got there, he was one of the few veteran pitchers at that time that would talk to me. Well, it was a little different now. Believe me, when we were trying to make one of the positions on the Detroit staff in 1955, when there were only 16 teams, and he helped me adjust to the major leagues by telling me generally this: now, you've got $1 million arm and a nickel head. If you could adjust a little bit, you might be able to stay here for a while. He didn't say it necessarily in those terms, but that was the idea, that you were blessed with a good arm now. Adjust this major league, and you'd be a success. And I thank him publicly for it tonight and for his friendship over the years. I'd like to start out by telling you just one baseball story. If you've heard it before, you're going to have to grin and bear it. But I'm going to tell it anyway because I think it's good to relax. I've done an awful lot of talking and I've bored an awful lot of audiences, but I wanted to start out with one baseball story this evening. And when I got a little time left at the end, I'll let you ask any questions that you might have. This one night in Tiger Stadium, and I don't know, Arch, if you were still with the Tigers in 61 or not. You were. Maybe you remember the day or the evening. I started the ball game against the Yankees. And Bob Turley had been a great pitcher. And he was excellent at stealing signs, either by the way the pitcher threw the ball, or he was able to get signs from the catcher and relay the pitches to the hitter so that they would know what was coming before you threw it. On this particular day, the leadoff hitter was Bobby Richardson. And as I pitched to Richardson, I could hear Turley whistle every time I threw a fastball. And if I threw a curve or a slider, any breaking ball, dead silence. Now, you hear that when you're on the mound. And so I became keenly aware that he was signaling the signs to Richardson. Now, Richardson wasn't going to hurt me too much. If he hit his best shot, it would be right to the track. But he hit a high fastball that I threw him, and he popped up to the shortstop. He knew what was coming. Tony Kubek was the next hitter. He was their shortstop. Pretty good low fastball hitter, and that's where I generally try to pitch. But every time I threw the fastball, Turley whistled. Every time I threw a slider or a curve, nothing. Kubek hit a low fastball right at the second baseman, two outs. The next hitter was Mickey Mantle, and I became a little concerned that Mantle would know what was coming because he had hit me fairly well not knowing what was coming. So I was a little young and foolish at the time. I was about 25 and I feared nothing, so I kind of did a semicircle over to the coaching box, just a little one in Detroit, and said, "If you whistle, I'm going to drill it." And I walked up towards home plate, and Dick Brown was my catcher. And Dick Brown, I told him, I said, "If he whistles, we hit him." And Mantle's in the on-deck circle. So back to the mound I go. And sure enough, I went into my windup. And so I threw a little slider. And that doesn't take much skill because you just spin the ball a little bit. It breaks about 4 inches. But it was aimed inside and it hit Mantle in the middle of his back. Now, he started out to talk things over. But the fact of the matter is, Brown got in front of him and then diverted him to first base. Now, I don't know what I would have done had he got there because I couldn't outrun him. And he was stronger than I was. But Brown talked him into going to first base. The reason I remember this story so well is that Mantle, before he passed away, told this story on Good Morning's CBS Good Morning, and I had forgotten till I heard about it. This given night, instead of Roger Maris, who always hit behind Mantle in 61, somehow Yogi was hitting in the fourth slot. Now I have a man on first base, two outs, Barrett to play. You know, you have to go into your stretch. You can't wind up anymore. So I said, there'll be no more whistling. I've already taken care of that by hitting Mantle in there. But sure enough, I go into my stretch, and Turley whistles. So I step back off the mound. Yogi steps out of the batter's box, cups his hands, drops the bat, said, Jim, he's whistling, but I ain't listening. I gotta tell you the rest of the story, because when I was inducted last year to the Hall of Fame, on Sunday night of the induction, only members of the Hall of Fame gather for a little dinner to roast the new members. And so I told this story. And Yogi was there, and Yogi said, Jim, it's easy for me about that story, and I wouldn't take the signs anytime. He said, I hit you so well without knowing what was coming. And as I see in that wonderful red book, he did. He hit 9 home runs off me. Well, that little story can fit into about anything that I talk about, whether it's in politics, whether it's in any kind of little talk that I might make. If I'm trying to show you how unresponsive Congress is, that story fits. People are whistling, Congress isn't listening. So I've used it a lot. And that's one story, is not the only thing I brought from my years of baseball. I believe that a lot of the skills that I developed in baseball have prepared me well to serve in any life, whether it's politics, whether it's anything else that you might choose. First of all, you have to have a thick skin. Baseball taught me that. In politics, you have to have a thick skin, particularly if you're a Republican in Kentucky. But let me tell you, if you've ever been booed by 65,000 people in Yankee Stadium on the 4th of July, facing a few hecklers in an audience shouldn't bother you at all. And I think baseball helped me develop a lot of other skills that have made the transition to politics pretty easy. Self-confidence, a respect for teamwork, self-control, and a love of competition. In fact, my present life, I've learned that the House of Representatives is just as competitive as any baseball diamond. The competition is one of ideas, not runs and strikeouts and hits and all those kind of things, but the competition is just as fierce as any pennant race. And I've discovered that people who succeed in this battle are the ones that have the most developed sense of competition and teamwork. And that is what baseball provided me for 27 years, more than anything else. And I think that even now, even after the Hall of Fame, something I waited and dreamed about for years, 25 years later, after my last game, I was voted in. So I thought I was going to go in posthumously. Well, I can tell you a story about Ernie Lombardi and how he yearned for the Hall of Fame. And I got to know him when he was a scout and a troubleshooter for the San Francisco Giants, and how bitter he became because he thought he deserved to be in, and obviously he went in posthumously. He didn't get to appreciate that day. His family did, but he didn't. So I didn't want that to happen to me. And thank God it didn't. So even after waiting for that much time, even after 11 years of serving in the Congress, I still have that competitive fire that is pushing me onward. It keeps me going. And obviously, I'm leaving the House of Representatives. I've decided to try the whole state and run for the U.S. Senate. That's a different kind of a deal than anything that I've ever done before since 1983. So the competitive fires that baseball created in me are still burning very brightly. I hope that will never change. That's what baseball did for me. And of course, some things have changed since I left baseball. Expansion. There will be 30 teams in the major leagues next year. There were 16 when I got there. That means 560 more major leaguers than when I played, when I first got to the major leagues. That's why teams are having trouble finding a third, a fourth, or a fifth starting pitcher. The talent pool and the amateur baseball and college baseball has not produced enough talent to fill out all of the major league rosters with as good a quality as we might have hoped for. Major League Baseball ought to remember one thing. I'm talking about ownership in Major League Baseball. They ought to subsidize the college programs to where they do away with metal bats. And they ought to subsidize high school and American Legion ball, where they furnish wood bats for those teams that are playing. I'll tell you, you can't watch a game at the major league level and not understand how much metal bats have distorted people's abilities and people's judgments and pitchers' inability to pitch inside, and because there's no reason to pitch inside because you can't do any good, you can't shatter a bat if they're swinging a metal bat. So the Major League ought to take that under consideration. Since I left baseball, the free market and all of the changes that brought and the cost of Major Leagues and the cost of producing a team at the Major League level. One player now is worth more than the whole franchise. One player's salary. When I got to the Detroit Tiger team in 1955 for the first time, in 56 for a little bit, but in 57, the whole franchise wasn't worth $11 million. Now they're paying one player $11 million. My observation is that you can't build a team with free market alone. It works for a couple of years and a couple of players. You might get away with it for a season or two, but over the long haul, the free market can never replace a good player development program. The great organizations like the Dodgers, the Braves, and teams with good player development have proven that year after year after year. And those teams that spend on player development are the ones that succeed year after year after year. We'll see if the Miami franchise can buy a contending and or a playoff team. Tom Yawkey in Boston was never able to buy that type of ball club in our era, because he tried year after year. The lack of a commissioner in baseball. No debt, Ned, I do not want that job. Can you imagine 30 corporate owners and I agreeing on anything over the long haul? No, they haven't had one for 6 years. Baseball has been rudderless for 6 years. My observation is that we need one. An executive committee is a sorry substitute for a strong commissioner. Baseball needs to hire a commissioner, give him some authority, or her some authority, and they need a CEO and a marketing manager to aggressively market baseball. Baseball caps and uniforms are doing fine, but what baseball really needs is to do what the NBA does best. Market the best in the world, the players themselves, the Michael Jordans, the Shaquille O'Neals. That's what baseball needs to do. During my speech last year at Cooperstown, I suggested that players better wake up and recognize their responsibilities to the fans. After the negative impact of the playoffs being blown and the World Series being blown, I felt that the fans could go either way. They could come back or they could walk away. And whether you like, as a traditionalist, like interleague play or not, the first experiment in interleague play was a big success. Because the fans in Cleveland were glad to see the Reds. The fans in Baltimore were glad to see the Braves. The same in reverse. And I think over a period of time, if they do get 15 teams in each league, which they'll have next year, five in each division, and you can play your division a heck of a lot more than you play in the other division, so that you can really decide who's going to win the pennant in your division, baseball will be better off. And I think with a balanced schedule, with twice as many games in your division, it will be successful, and the fans will start coming back. But since that time, since the players struck and the owners wouldn't give in, and I'm not going to get into the who was right, who was wrong, I think there's some encouraging signs that the players are becoming completely aware of what their responsibilities are and are beginning to recognize that high salaries can't be there if they don't draw the people to pay them. You know, you can make only so much off television and radio, and you've got to put people in the ballpark if you're going to be successful. My final observation is that old new ballparks are a great improvement. The new old ballparks like Baltimore, Cleveland, Texas, Denver, Atlanta, I love them. They restore or recapture the feeling and the kind of atmosphere that we used to have at Fenway Park and Tiger Stadium, Crosley Field, all those old parks that had some character. It's a great improvement over the parks that were built with a cookie cutter. The ones that were 325 down both lines, 375 in left and right center, and 410 in center field. And the fans were so far away from the players, they couldn't recognize them if they had binoculars. So I think the new parks, and I've spent some time in Camden Yards, are really fun to watch baseball. The new parks are home, team friendly, or at least if they have smart general managers, and they're fan friendly. Those are my observations. Let me tell you, I watch as much baseball as I possibly can in the time I have, but I still have a great love for the game because it gave me a chance to do things that I never thought I would ever be able to do in my lifetime. Let me tell you how important this day is to me. This morning at 6:20, our 31st grandchild was born. June 21st, and 33 years ago, I pitched a perfect game. My newest grandson's name was going to be David Lewis after his father, but since the young baby was born on my anniversary of the perfect game, they changed the name to James Lewis, which is my name and my father's name. So we have a son named after us this morning. Thank you. Now I'll take any questions that you might have. Yes, sir.
What is your position, if any, on public sector money being used to finance all the new stadiums that you're talking about? Do you think that's healthy or unhealthy in the long
run? It's healthy if the people have voted the tax on themselves to pay for it. It's unhealthy if it's done otherwise. Cincinnati voted the tax to build two new stadiums. They want to pay that tax. God bless them. But they shouldn't go through the generals. I'll give you a for instance. The new Comiskey Park in Chicago was built with $250 million worth of taxpayers' money. The new ballpark in Milwaukee is going to be built with $225 million worth of taxpayers' money. I think that's wrong. And I think that the taxpayers are getting hooked. Now, the other way, I think it's fine. Yes?
You think that the owners will ever accept a Stern commissioner?
No. They don't want a strong commissioner. That's why they've gutted the office.
Could you go back to that perfect game and you tell us what you remember of that night and your feelings during the game and after?
Okay, I'll try to. It was a Sunday afternoon. It was 94 degrees in Shea Stadium. It was the first game of a doubleheader. And early in the game, I made some mistakes and got away with them. Now, the Mets weren't the Yankees of 1961, but they did have some pretty good hitters on the club. So the first inning, I threw a couple high sliders, were fouled back. Then as the game progressed, I got better control and better command of my stuff. And by the fifth inning, after I had almost blown it by throwing Jesse Gunner, the only straight changeup that I threw all day, and Tony Taylor dove in the hole in between first and second and threw Gunner out from his knees because he didn't run very well. I stayed with fastball, slider, and regular curve. No changeups the rest of the game, and my control was pretty good. And I thought when I got to the seventh inning, I was trying to figure out who Casey would pinch hit in the ninth inning. And sure enough, he pinch hit in reverse order. I was glad the last two outs were Altman, George Altman, who was a good hitter,
yeah,
and Johnny Stevenson, a fellow Kentuckian. I thought it would be the opposite. I thought Stevenson would hit first and Altman would hit second. But Casey sent up Altman, and he struck out on a curveball. And Stevenson, I found out early that year in pitching to him, in a game in Philadelphia, that he couldn't handle a curveball very well. So I threw five curveballs, and he swung at the fifth one. And it was a 2-2 count, so he struck out. Yes, Paul?
Jim, the net dollar didn't have to include the tip.
That didn't include the tip.
I was told. I was
told. He went down. I don't know if it included the tip or not.
Extreme in 1964,
and
the Phillies lost
pennant.
It's not my World Series
ticket,
by the way.
So do I. 30 sets of them.
Did you were short? Anyone go to lock and say something was wrong with the rotation?
No, just the opposite. We were all sure. You had to be there. You had to be inside the clubhouse. And for some of us who have had the good fortune of being inside, Mock ran into a real problem. He lost confidence in Mahaffey. Dennis Bennett and Ray Culp were hurt. And Short and I were the only healthy starting pitchers he had, except for Mahaffey. So when we got into the losing streak, when Chico Ruiz stole home with two strikes on Frank Robinson, yeah, Dad, I know it's hard to understand. We couldn't understand it either. That was the first loss of the streak. 1-0, the Reds beat us that night, and Ruiz steal of home was the only run that they got. And then Mahaffey had a 4-1 lead on a Friday after we had lost four, and we were playing. playing against the Braves, a four-game series, and he took Mahaffey out after he walked the leadoff hitter in the eighth inning, and all heck broke loose after that. We lost it in the tenth inning with Rico Carty hitting off of Bobby Shantz. That's a combination you shouldn't want at any time. Not that Bobby wasn't a great pitcher, but if you could find another right-hander to pitch against Carty, you're a lot better off. By the time we got to Sunday against the Braves, we had lost six in a row, and Mock had no pitcher to start on Sunday. I went in and volunteered. I got beat 14-8. Then Bennett tried to pitch on Monday. He could not throw the ball from here to home plate, and he got beat. Short pitched on Tuesday against the Cardinals and got beat. I pitched on Wednesday against the Cardinals and lost also. We had a day off Thursday. Went to Cincinnati. We had a split game. We only had two games to play against Cincinnati. Friday and Sunday. Don't ask me why. I didn't make the schedule up. We hadn't had a day off in 45 games. That's the real reason that we lost the pennant. We had scheduled games and postponed games early in the season, figuring we could get larger crowds in the Climax Stadium late in the season if we were contending. The big problem is we were contending all year, and we got to the point where we had 45 straight days of playing, and our pitching staff just blew out except for Sharp and myself. No, just the opposite. No one else would take the ball. And you had to be inside the clubhouse to find that out.
Congressman, before I ask my question, with respect, in every situation where the voters have taxed themselves for a contribution for a stadium, they wind up paying a great deal more than they agreed to. In your old stamping grounds, we were told that we were voting for a $40 million contribution, no more, not $1 million more. At the time we were told this, it was a $5 million.
Where's my old stamping grounds?
Detroit.
Detroit, okay. Well, I mean, I've been 14.
I have, so the fact is the voters, there is no respect for what the voters do. Once they authorize it, the land grab and the grab begins. Two questions. One, I passed since I was 12 years old, living in Detroit, and weeping over the news in Detroit. Who the hell is Don Becker? The other question is the disappointed, the weeping children of Detroit want to know why he went to the Hall of Fame as a Philly, not a Tiger.
Okay, that's a very good question. The second one, I'll be glad to answer it last. The first thing about building a stadium and taxing, it can be done properly if you have good local officials. If you don't, you will have a problem. I don't believe, because it's tax money, that there should be carte blanche on what kind of stadium you build. You have to build within the means or the tax base that you set up to pay for it. I went into the Hall of Fame as a Philly because I haven't heard from the Detroit Tigers since 1963. And the Phillies have made every effort to keep in touch with me since I played for them for 6 years. I won 118 games in Detroit, never heard from them, except when I got voted into the Hall of Fame and they wrote me and said, of course you're going in as a Tiger. And I wrote back and said, no, I'm going in as a Philly. That's the main reason. Yes?
Near the end of your appearance, Tigers, a lot of young players who built the championship in the team in 68 were coming up, like Bill Breehan, Mickey Lowich, and
yes.
Could you share some thoughts about those players, seeing them while they were young?
Well, Bill Breehan was our regular catcher in 62, and well, not 62, but 63. He shared catching in 62. It was came up at the end of the year, but he still shared a lot of it in 63. My last year with Detroit was his first regular season. Lowich was a good pitcher. He came up during the 63 season and pitched very well as a starting pitcher. Denny McClain came up only in the last month, and that's when Charlie Dressen decided that I couldn't start anymore. that I was over the hill at age 30, by the way, age 30, that I had pitched to the point where I couldn't pitch nine innings. Well, eight full seasons in the National League and about 100 complete games later, I think he made an early mistaken judgment. Donnie Wirt, also, Dick McAuliffe had come up at that time. They were building young players, and they kept a few veterans around, like Kaline still stayed around and Cash still stayed around. But they had built the nucleus of a good young ball club, and I was sorry that... But I went to Jimmy Campbell after the 1963 season and asked him if he can make a trade. It's time for me to go. You depreciated me down to zero here in Detroit. Now let me go somewhere else where they can depreciate me for another 8 years. And that's what happened.
And thank you, Dr. Benjamin.
Thanks.
For my 14th birthday, I got tickets for that 14th birthday. A couple of things. In that game, Joe Torre hit what I think is the hardest hit ball I've ever seen. I don't know if you remember anything about that. And then also, for the whole season, comment maybe on Dick Allen.
Which game? Are you speaking about the Sunday game? The only thing I can remember is Torrey got two doubles off of me. Both, one on the right field line and one on the left field line.
Well, you may have been gone.
Well, I was gone fairly early, so you could be right. Dick Allen was probably the best young talent that I had seen come up in the major leagues. He could do everything fairly well, but he could really hit. The 64 season, he didn't do anything wrong. I mean, he did everything right. It was a little later in Philadelphia is when Dick Allen had some problems. And he had him with Frank Thomas, and that's another story. Way back.
How do you feel about today's pitchers? You met both pitched a lot of complete games. You went the distance. Today it seems like 90 pitches and the guy's out.
They're trained that way. I mean, that's the way they're trained in the minor leagues. Five-man rotation. That's what I'm getting back to the college and high school training ground when I said get rid of the metal bats so that the pitchers can actually learn how to pitch, go in and out and in and out, up and down. I never worried about going up and down because I threw enough up by accident. But I went in and out fairly well. But now they don't train pitchers that way because the training ground doesn't come up until they get to professional baseball. Because there's no sense in training somebody to pitch inside if it does no good. You know, what I think of the pitchers, there's an awful lot of good ones right now that I like to watch. I can watch the Atlanta Braves on the Superstation any night and pretty well watch any of their pitchers and get a real enjoyment out of watching at least their starting pitchers pitch. And I can turn into Baltimore and watch some of their pitchers, Rucina and Key and a couple others. And the other night I watched Maddox and Clemens pitch against each other. So there are still an awful lot of good pitchers that know how to pitch. But I don't know why they walk off the mound after eight innings with a two-hit shutout. I mean, and then bring in somebody to get the last three outs for them. We were always looking, there was nobody better down the bullpen. So you better complete what you have. Because when we played the game at the major league level, it went like this. The four best pitchers were your starters, and everything else, unless you had a hammer, in which I never pitched with one, somebody that was the hammer down the bullpen. I never had one. I had one for a half a year in Philly in two different seasons. Darryl Knowles, for a half a year, was as good as a relief pitcher that I ever had pick me up. And Jack Balsh, for a half a year, was as good a relief pitcher as ever had picked me up. But other than that, you know, we had Joe Horner sometimes and Dick Selma sometimes, but I never had Mark Wohlers, who would pick up the last three outs. So I thought I was better than anybody in the bullpen. I wouldn't trust my game with that. So I would rather finish the game myself. I think all of the pitchers that came up during our era were like that. Now they're trained differently. I didn't know 120 pitches was a lot of pitches. No, I really didn't. I thought whatever it took to pitch nine innings was what it was. Sometimes you threw 145, 150.
You talked about realignment and adjusting the lead. What's your thinking on the DH?
I'm not a big DH fan. Not at all. I've never been. And obviously, it's in the American League. It's going to stay there as long as the Player Association and the management can't do away with it. What they ought to do is set a deadline and say, you know, after 5 years and all the DHs are worn out, no more DH.
Most of them.
Or they ought to put it in the National League, one of the two, because why do you have two different rules for the same game? You
know. As a congressman, what will Congress do in relation to baseball as far as that?
Antitrust exemption?
Exactly.
We will probably pass the agreed language between players and the owners and do away with the Sherman antitrust exemption for our labor negotiations. I had a bill in for the last 3 years to do that. Now we have language from the agreement between the players and the owners from last year that will generally lead to something passing in the Senate, and finally we'll do something with the House Judiciary Committee under Henry Hyde and generally pass what they have agreed on.
When do you think that might?
Probably this summer. Then the NLRB or some other agency or mediation or conciliation. Thank you. There is a federal agency that does those sorts of things, but it will be just like football, the labor relationship now, where the courts can make the decision on right or wrong, who's right, what the settlement should be. Yes?
Let's go back before the perfect game to your first no-hitter.
Okay.
The first one I ever saw on television was the new beat, the Red Sox. Do you have any recollections of that?
You bet I do. I don't know how many no-hitters have been pitched at Fenway. I think Mel Parnell might have pitched one. But facing Ted Williams and getting him out four times in a row is always a thrill for me. I didn't do that too often. As I looked in my book, the first home run I gave up in the major leagues was to Ted Williams, and I know one of the last ones I gave, or he hit, was off of me in Tiger Stadium. He got out of a sick bed to come out and play. So I remember that game very well for one reason. 2 years ago, I went to a fundraising down in Florida where Ted lives for a fellow congressperson, and I had lunch with Ted Williams, and he told me this story. He said, I've been wanting to tell you this for 37 years. He said, we knew every pitch that you threw. Del Baker was signaling to every hitter in that game. I said, well, why didn't you get a hit then? He said, we were all over swinging. We were so anxious to hit the ball because we thought we knew what was coming. He said, the only time we didn't know what was coming was my last at-bat because the fans were screaming so loud that I couldn't hear the signals. So that's a matter of fact that he waited 37 years to tell me. I'm glad he didn't tell me the day after the game.
Congressman Bunning, now that you're in the Hall of Fame, who among your contemporaries do you think should be there too? And I'm particularly thinking of Bill Mazeroski and Ron Santo.
Well, first of all, I'd like to see one of the largest winners in Major League history, Don Sutton, go in. He has 324 or 26 wins. I'm not quite sure which one that is. Around 24. He's in the top 10 as far as Major League wins on the all-time win list. He's in the top 10 in strikeouts. He was a teammate of mine with the Dodgers, and I played there for a short period of time. So I think he ought to be one that goes in. I'd like to see Tony Perez put in the Hall of Fame because he's about 16th, I think, or 17th on the all-time list for runs batted in, and was tougher for me to get out than all of the other guys on the big red machine at the time. And he always drove in the important runs for the Reds. Mazeroski, without any question, and I'm not taking anything away from anybody that played second base, was the best second baseman I ever seen, bar none. He made the double play better than anyone that I'd ever seen. I played with him for a year and a half, and the ball never looked like it hit his glove. It just turned it. And he hit. Now would be, you know, $3-4 million player because he hit 255, 260. And my gosh, how many second basemen do that? And he also had some power. So, and Santo was a very tough out in Chicago. Trouble is, same as me, you never played any winners. And that's always a problem. If you don't play in a World Series, people don't get to see you very much. If you've only been in All-Star games, that's important, but it isn't as important as playing in World Series. I found that out.
What are your thoughts on the antitrust protection of the minor leagues?
They are completely exempt. This bill does nothing. The bill that I'm talking about does nothing and excludes the minor leagues. In other words, the majors and minors have just signed a new 10-year agreement that they seem to be happy with. So what we have done is totally exempt the minor leagues and completely allow them to do what they do with exemption to the Sherman antitrust laws.
I think the minor leagues needs that. Some great ball players came from independent minor leagues.
Well, and they're doing it now. I think the more independent minor league teams that you can have, the better off you'll be. When we first signed, and Ned signed with a Toledo team as an independent, mm-hmm. Just like the St. Paul team now is a place where people try to go to resurrect their careers. They're an independent team. I think the more independent teams that you can have, the better off you are. Way back.
My Congressman Mark Newman is a great believer in fiscal responsibility of this government. So how do you feel about him?
How do I feel about him? He's going to run for the U.S. Senate.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I work with him on the budget committee. He's on the committee with me on the budget. He does a good job, very good job. Go ahead, young man.
Well, everybody says it's a perfect game. I can remember shutting the Cubs out in Wrigley Field, pitching a four hitter with a wind blowing out. I thought it was the best game I'd ever pitched. You don't know how hard it is to pitch in that park in Wrigley Field with the wind blowing out, especially with Billy Williams and Santo and Beckert and Banks and all the hitters they had. I thought I'd pitched a better ball game never in my life than that four hitter.
Jim, how did you know that your big league career was over, and was the adjustment from a
baseball player? Boy, was it easy. It's easy to figure out. Let me tell you how easy it was figure it out.
Was the adjustment from being a ball player to more of a civilian life an easy adjustment for you?
Well, let's answer the first one first. When Tito Fuentes and Roger Metzger hit home runs off of me, I knew it was time to quit. Because my slider was still sliding, but it wasn't sliding fast enough. Was it tough, or was the adjustment tough? For 9 months it was tough. I was fortunate enough to have saved some money. I was fortunate enough to make enough in my major league career to save a few dollars. So it wasn't a critical transition as far as dollars and cents, but it was a transition of getting adjusted to the real world. What we used to call the lunch bucket league, where you go to work and you work on a scheduled time. In baseball, you don't have scheduled times. You do when you start the game and those kind of things, but it's a different type of lifestyle. And so, yes, there was an adjustment. About 9 months it took me to get back to normal. And I've been back to normal fairly well ever since. Way in the back.
Jim, tell us about Hank Aaron's home run.
Okay. He hit one off of me. And it was an inside the park. And it was a line drive in Connie Mack Stadium, or Old Chide Park, whichever you choose to call it. Don Locke was our center fielder, and if you've been in the old ballpark in Philadelphia, it's 447 feet to dead center field. And Aaron hit a line drive right over second base, and Locke came in and tried to shoestring it, and he missed it. And it went all the way to the wall, and Aaron circled the bases. That's the story of... I never threw Henry Aaron any hard fastballs that he could even get to. Because I watched Drysdale try to do that, and he hit a ton of home runs off Drysdale trying to pitch him in here.
Would you talk about the various managers you played for in relation to their handling of pitching?
Woo.
And of all the managers you played for, if you owned a team, which one would you hire?
Whoa. Well, first of all, in Detroit, we had a manager a year. I played in Detroit for 8 seasons, and we had 7 managers. We traded managers in Detroit. We traded Jimmy Dykes for Joe Gordon. Usually they trade Harvey Keene for Rocky Colavito. We got Joe Gordon. I didn't get to know Joe Gordon because he quit at the end of the season. I mean, he wasn't there like 8 weeks, and he quit. The best one-on-one, personal, friendly, interested in you as a person manager that I had, not just your baseball career, was Bob Sheffing. He came to Detroit in 61, 62, and until they fired him in 63, when Charlie Dressen took the ball club. He was a very warm, personable, and knew the game fairly well, and got most of the talent out of the players that he had. The best manager I ever had was Gene Mupp, as far as managing the game. Managing the game, and he never won. I know he never won. He knows he never won. But he was always had the best pinch hitter ready, no matter who they put in. Now, he wasn't a good manager of people.
He, especially pitchers, he thought we were odd anyway to start with. Not real athletes. And so he once called me after he got the job in Minnesota and asked me to be his pitching coach. And I said, do you want me to be a pitching coach or do you want me to coach your pitchers? Because I knew that he wouldn't give up the reins of running the pitching staff if I got there. And so I said, no, thank you. But he was the best baseball man. I guess I would have to pick Bach and getting someone who was a coach who could get between the players and him and let him run the game and let somebody else intercede between the players if I had to choose.
Jim, let's just go with one more.
One or two more? One?
Yeah, go ahead. How discouraging did it get to 57 when you lost the 6-1 nothing game and
5. I won 3.
It was 17 and 15 or something like that.
It was the best year of my life as far as pitching is concerned. How frustrating was it? Go ahead, Esther, what's
the
second?
The other question was, what happened in 68 when you went to Pittsburgh?
I got hurt. First of all, how frustrating. It wasn't frustrating. Everybody in 1967 that pitched for the Phillies knew when we went out, if we gave up more than 2 runs, we were in deep trouble. Because we didn't score. The 67 Phillies played good defense and didn't score much. So I didn't realize that in 8 starts, I got 3 runs and won 3 out of the 8.
Wow.
Now, you've heard of pitching in hard luck. That's all. That's what we consider. I never pitched better in my life than I did in 1967. I mean, if you go back and check innings pitched, strikeouts, hits allowed, the whole what you consider are important things for pitching categories. But I won 17, and Mike McCormick was the Cy Young Award winner, and his earned run average was in the 4s or high 3s. Mine was almost in the 1s. So we won 22 games. Last question.
What was the effect on the 65 Phillies of bringing in Bo Belinsky and Dick Stewart?
Oh,
he's going to pull it off.
We were wondering, you know, I have to tell you this story. Bo Belinsky. He's a 20-game winner. Lifetime. Now, he's a good guy, but he won 20-some games total. And Dick Stewart could never get his uniform and his gloves on right. And Gene Mock was darn well sure he was going to learn how to field. So instead of letting him go up and hit fresh and strong, he wore him out trying to make a good fielding first baseman out of him. So he didn't do anything for us. He couldn't hit or field. So it wasn't a very good trade or a very good acquisition. Gene always thought that he could take the most unusual players and convert them back to being successful. That was what was in his mind. And unfortunately, it didn't work out all the time. I want to thank you for letting me come down.